From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, reaction to the capsizing of a migrant ship. Palestine and economic development highlight the Asia-Africa conference. The U.S.-European free trade negotiations resume. And a new report on the environment and society.
How can we all get a piece of a dignified life on this planet without trashing the planet? I think that's the big challenge.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. People or more are feared dead from the capsized migrant vessel off the coast of Libya. The exact number will likely never be known. By nightfall Sunday, authorities said 28 people had been rescued about 200 kilometers south of the Italian island of Lampedusa, and another 24 bodies were recovered. Rescue workers said the majority of the missing appeared trapped in the 20-meter vessel at the bottom of the sea. The Southern European representative of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Laurent Jolet, says the hard-pressed Italian Coast Guard is unprepared for such operations.
The Coast Guard are, you know, with the small capacity that they have, are doing whatever they can to rescue lives, going very, very close to Libya if necessary, and you know, working non-stop day and night. But it is clear that they need help. They need help either financially, but, you know, substantially, or there has to be something else put in place in a European context, and that really needs to happen.
The mass drowning, if confirmed, would bring the death toll this year to 1,500 among the thousands who have survived the dangerous journey.
Chiediamo di non essere lasciati soli, non tanto nell'emergenza in mare.
Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi says his country cannot be left alone to deal with this crisis. He called it more than a humanitarian tragedy, but a national security matter to bring a halt to human trafficking. In his weekly address in St. Peter's Square, Pope Francis called on the international community to prevent more migrant disasters. The pontiff also called for much greater international involvement in the burgeoning crisis. On the second day of the Asia-Africa conference in Jakarta, Indonesia's foreign minister advocated for an independent Palestinian state and promised that the summit will produce a unified political message. But as VOA's Brian Padden reports, improving economic ties is the top priority for many of the delegates, especially in Africa, where development has lagged behind Asia.
High-ranking ministers from over 70 participating countries in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East gathered in Jakarta for the second day of the Asia-Africa Conference. The week-long summit and commemoration seeks to revive ties among developing countries that first came together in Indonesia 60 years ago at the historic Bandung Conference. In her opening remarks, Indonesia's Foreign Affairs Minister Retno Marsudi noted that support for independence from colonialism was the cause that united these countries in 1955. At this year's conference, she says Indonesia wants to make independence for the Palestinian territories controlled by Israel a similar unifying cause.
An issue that also merits our continued support and attention is the issue of Palestine. Indonesia remains steadfast in its wavering support for an independent Palestine within the context of two-state solution.
The Palestinian foreign minister, Riyad Mawki, also addressed the conference Monday. He pressed the delegates to consider a new push for full membership for Palestine at the United Nations and to put economic pressure on Israel.
We should start talking about sanctions being imposed on Israel for violating international law and for negating the Palestinians' their basic rights.
The United Nations General Assembly voted in 2012 to grant Palestine non-member observer state status in the UN. A proposal for setting a deadline for granting the Palestinian region statehood later failed to pass the UN Security Council. While there may be broad support for Palestinian statehood at the conference, many African delegates have come to Jakarta seeking better trade ties. So far, there has been much talk about South-South and triangular cooperation. These are terms that refer to how emerging countries like Indonesia either provide direct aid or, with advanced countries, provide assistance to less developed countries. But there have been few specifics offered as to what kind of programs they are talking about and how much monetary support might be offered. Samori Angwa Okwiya, Kenya's High Commissioner to Indonesia, Philippines, and Brunei, says details will be forthcoming this week.
since the last conference. We are looking at very new areas of interest. I can't really go into details right now, but I'm sure at the end of the summit, we'll be able to come up with very concrete resolutions that are going to affect the cooperation between Asia and Africa.
Some delegates say the bilateral talks happening on the sideline are just as important as the main conference in making trade and development deals between African and Asian countries. Berhane Gabra Christos, a high-ranking ambassador with Ethiopia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, is optimistic after meeting with his Indonesian counterpart.
We're going to work on details, but the potentials are huge on agriculture, on labor-intensive investment like textile, oil, and name it.
Tuesday, heads of state from China, Japan, South Africa, Ethiopia, and Pakistan are scheduled to address the conference. And on Friday, a number of heads of state will travel to Bandung to reenact a historical procession that was part of the first conference 60 years ago. Brian Patton, VOA News, Jakarta.
Chinese President Xi Jinping is in Pakistan to launch a major investment program to boost the South Asian country's infrastructure and energy needs. The China-Pakistan Economic Corridor will involve a network of rails, roads, and pipelines through Pakistan to facilitate the transport of oil from the Arabian Sea and Indian Ocean to China. The two countries are also expected to cooperate in gas, coal, and solar energy projects to provide more than 16,000 megawatts of electricity, about double Pakistan's current capacity. In an editorial Sunday, the state-run China Daily Global Times says Beijing views the relationship as one between equal partners, referring to Pakistan as China's iron brother. It says over the next 15 years, the $46 billion Chinese investment will include the construction of roads, railways, pipelines, fiber optic cables, power facilities, and economic development zones. China analyst Kerry Brown of the University of Sydney, Australia, tells VOA's Victor Beatty this project is part of China's economic initiative of greater cooperation called One Belt and One Road.
Pakistan and China have been very close allies, at least rhetorically, for a long time. And it's really, I suppose, a moment under Xi Jinping when, you know, with his new sort of worldview, this idea of, you know, the new Silk Road, basically, the One Road, One Belt, it's a time of seeing where Pakistan fits into that. There are all sorts of security issues that Pakistan and China do have in common, but also have issues over. And there's also a sense in many ways that Pakistan has not actually got as much economic benefit from this relationship as it could have. So I think this is really a moment when they can recharge this relationship and see where it slots into all of the other things that China is doing in the region, rather than, you know, just assuming that they have a great relationship and not really doing anything about it.
This is a major investment package, $46 billion. It dwarfs the U.S. aid package going to Pakistan. Is China kind of filling a vacuum now that the U.S. has pulled back from Afghanistan?
I think it's very vulnerable. It doesn't share a huge border with Pakistan, but it's strategically a very important one. And obviously, even with the issue of, America now withdrawing from Afghanistan, the kinds of security issues that poses for China, particularly in the Xinjiang region, where it does feel that it has enormous security issues, you know, this means that Pakistan is strategically very important for China. It's a country that it has always enjoyed good diplomatic relations with, but it doesn't really have a strong kind of cultural dialogue with the country. And so there's all sorts of possibilities for misunderstanding. And the bottom line basically is China shares a border and also shares strategic space with Pakistan in ways which are much more immediate and pressing than America. America is remote. Pakistan is right next to China. So it feels it needs to have a stronger voice there and a stronger reason for being there. And economic links, of course, and aid packages are very, very tangible ways of, you know, sort of promoting this link.
How would you equate relations between those two countries with China's relationship with India?
Yes, I mean, the issue really is that with India, China still has an unresolved border issue, well, two unresolved border issues. And so it's always got a very complicated relationship, particularly now that India is economically much more important. There's competition between the two. And Pakistan sort of sits between them. It's got a very complex relationship with India, of course. It's historically been a complicated relationship, and it doesn't look like even in the era in which both India and Pakistan are nuclear powers that that's going to get any less complicated. In a sense, the danger for China is that it could be played by Pakistan against India, less likely that India would play it against Pakistan, and so it needs to really defend its interests with Pakistan, its security interests, its trade interests, its strategic interests, but not get drawn into the very, very complicated, India-Pakistan issues where, you know, it may be forced to take sides. It just definitely doesn't want that.
The Chinese leader will also discuss terrorism and military sales during his two-day visit. Mr. Xi's visit was supposed to have taken place during his South Asian tour last year, but was postponed among anti-government protests in Pakistan. He also plans to travel to Indonesia to take part in an Asian-African summit in Jakarta on Wednesday. The ninth round of U.S.-European Union negotiations on the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership Agreement gets underway today in New York. At the same time, the U.S. and Japan held talks in Tokyo on the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal as pressure mounts on the U.S. Congress to grant President Obama trade promotion authority. Victor rejoins us with this report.
The latest round of the TTIP negotiations, begun nearly 2 years ago, is expected to last 4 days. The talks are aimed at removing tariffs, cutting red tape, and reducing restrictions on investment in a trade area that covers 800 million people. The pact is said to have the potential to create 13 million transatlantic jobs. U.S. President Barack Obama has called for major progress this year with the 28-nation European Union, America's top export market, now that a bipartisan measure granting him trade promotion authority has been introduced in the U.S. Congress.
In this framework, for the first time, there are requirements for enforceable labor environmental provisions. There is a clear attention to issues like human rights. And in many ways, this is the most far-reaching and progressive trade promotion authority that we've seen going through Congress.
The TPA would only allow Congress to vote up or down on a trade agreement without the ability to make changes. However, it faces stiff opposition among congressional members of Mr. Obama's Democratic Party, including independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who appeared Sunday on U.S. television.
Over the years, we have lost millions of decent-paying jobs. These trade agreements have forced wages down in America, so the average worker in America today is working longer hours for lower wages. I think we do not need to send more jobs to low-wage countries. I think corporate America has got to start investing in this country and create decent-paying jobs here.
Mr. Obama says opposing the trade agreement would be a ratification of the status quo, where foreign companies sell in the U.S. market, but U.S. companies are not able to compete effectively overseas. Meanwhile, thousands took to the streets in Germany and elsewhere to oppose the transatlantic trade talks, denouncing what they see as a lack of transparency, favoritism toward large corporations, and undermining consumer rights. Gary Huffbauer, senior fellow at the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics, says this opposition likely will delay approval of TTIP until after Mr. Obama leaves office in 2017. However, he is more optimistic Mr. Obama will gain trade promotion authority soon, despite opposition from within his own party.
I think the votes are there. I think the opponents are on the defensive. It is true that President Obama has to round up some reluctant Democrats, but the power of the presidency is very, very great with respect to all sorts of things that congressmen want, and I think he will get the necessary 25 votes out of the Democrats to pass this in the House, and it will certainly pass in the Senate.
Huffbauer is also upbeat about the prospect of a breakthrough in U.S.-Japan talks on the 12-nation Asian Free Trade Pact known as TPP. He says he expects Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who is to make a state visit to Washington next week, to make the necessary concessions in Japan's beef, pork, and dairy markets to allow for a breakthrough. J.P. Morgan senior economist Masamichi Adachi in Tokyo says the discussions are about opening Japan's agricultural and auto sectors, as well as the U.S. auto parts market. But he says what really matters is the outcome of the Trade Promotion Authority debate in Washington.
If the Congress let the President Obama have this authority, then negotiation will be much easier. And that's a key event to probably we see the progress on this negotiation.
President Obama has warned that if the U.S. does not help shape the rules so American businesses and workers can compete in these fast-growing Asian markets, China will set up rules that advantage Chinese workers and businesses. Huffbauer says he expects a vote on Trade Promotion Authority by June, and ratification of the TPP will likely follow before the year is out. He expects the Asian Free Trade Agreement will result in greater U.S. involvement in setting the rules for the 21st century on such issues as state-owned enterprises, intellectual property, investment, and tariffs. Huffbauer calls TPP a gateway agreement for other countries to join, including South Korea, Thailand, Indonesia, and the Philippines. He even expects China to align itself with the agreement in 5 to 7 years. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
The World Watch Institute says hidden threats are imperiling the quest for sustainable societies around the world. In its new report, State of the World 2015, it says growing stress on the planet's resources could cause social upheaval, environmental imbalances, and disrupt economies. We spoke with World Watch Institute's Gary Gardner about the new publication.
In this edition, we wanted to try to focus on some of the issues that don't get as much attention as the more high-profile, you know, climate change and other issues that are dominating the headlines. So we pulled up a number of issues that we have been looking at for years and just wanted to try to feature them in this report.
What are those issues?
We're looking at, for example, growth, the problem of economic growth and how you can have infinite economic growth on a finite planet. I mean, on the face of it, that is problematic, and we explore that a little bit. We're looking at issues of agriculture and the loss of agricultural resources such as water and land and a stable climate. We look at things like stranded assets. This is something that has often focused on coal and oil, and the question being, can we continue to use these resources, and are they in fact still good investments for people if they will not be able to be pumped or mined in the future because of their carbon content? So it's a range of issues.
And could you give us some examples of how we can solve some of these problems?
Sure. In terms of agricultural resources, I think we need to be much better stewards of the land and water and, of course, the climate. We tend to look at land and see it as a commodity, for example, so we pave it over. And in the case of California, between 2008 and 2010, it lost an area of farmland that was equal to about three-quarters of the area of San Francisco. In the United States as a whole, we've lost an area equal to the state of Indiana in 25 years that's been paved over, farmland that's been paved over. So we need to be much better stewards, and we need to be treating food, for example, as a sacred commodity, not just another thing that we trade. It turns out that about one-third of the food in the world today is wasted, either at the farm level or at the home level or somewhere in between, and that's a huge loss. So we need to develop, I think, a better understanding of the value and importance of food.
Some people, especially in third world countries that are just coming along, they feel that the environment is secondary. They want to get ahead. They want to get up with everyone else. What is your reaction to that?
Well, it's very understandable, of course, when you need a job, when you need to feed your family, when you need to be able to get health care. All of those things are primary, I think, in any parent's worldview. So it's totally understandable. And the challenge for us in the 21st century is to build economies that are not in competition with the environment so that we can provide a lot of the economic goods and services that people need without having a huge environmental footprint. And that's the challenge we face moving forward. And there are ways to do that. When we talk now about circular economies, for example, economies in which there's very, very little waste because everything gets either recycled or reused or is turned into a service so that, for example, car sharing, which we're seeing increasingly in many cities, people can get access to a car without having to own a car. And that means that people have the transportation service they're looking for without all of the environmental impact that comes with production and of very resource-intensive good like a car.
When I was young, which was, of course, a very, 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 very long time ago, a lot of people just didn't care about the environment. They thought it was silly. But those opinions seem to have turned around now. People are much more accepting of thinking the environment is important.
I think so. I think you're absolutely right, and that gives me some hope for the future. And I, you know, as I indicated, we're trying to retool our economies so that they work in harmony with the environment. And I think that's a really exciting challenge and will be a fun and creative kind of challenge for the upcoming generations. How can we all, you know, get a piece of a dignified life on this planet without trashing the planet? I think that's the big challenge, and I'm very much looking forward to being part of that.
Gary Gardner, a senior fellow and director of publications at World Watch Institute. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and NATO remain committed to establishing a more capable ballistic missile defense, or BMD, to protect Europe from the threat posed by ballistic missiles from the Middle East. The U.S. commitment to NATO missile defense and the sites in Romania and Poland remains ironclad, said U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Arms Control, Verification, and Compliance, Frank Rose. The European Phased Adaptive Approach, or EPAA, announced by President Barack Obama in 2009, provides stronger, smarter, and swifter defenses of American forces and America's allies. Since then, there has been great progress in implementing the EPAA. Phase 1 became operational in 2011 with the deployment of an Aegis BMD-capable multi-role ship to the Mediterranean and the deployment of a radar in Turkey. Spain also agreed to host 4 Aegis BMD-capable ships at its naval facility in Rota. As part of Phase 2, Romania agreed in 2011 to host a U.S. Aegis ashore site that is on schedule to be completed by the end of 2015. And finally, Phase 3 will include an Aegis ashore site in Poland, equipped with the new SM-3 Block IIA interceptor. This site is on schedule for deployment in a 2018 timeframe, and the SM-3 Block IIA interceptor will be deployed on land and at sea later this decade. When combined with other EPAA assets, Phase 3 will provide the necessary capabilities to provide ballistic missile defense coverage of all NATO European territory. The United States is continuing to bolster BMD in other key regions such as the Middle East and the Asia Pacific. In the Middle East, the UAE has taken delivery of its Patriot PAC-3 batteries, which provide a lower-tier point defense of critical national assets. The U.S. is continuing its long-standing cooperation with Israel on missile defense on key systems such as Arrow 3, David Sling, and Iron Dome. In the Asia Pacific, in response to the North Korean ballistic missile threat, the U.S. and Japan are working to develop the SM-3 Block IIA interceptor and deployed in 2014 a second radar system to Japan, while continuing to enhance the interoperability between U.S. and Japanese forces. The U.S. is also consulting with South Korea as it develops its missile defense system, which is designed to defend against ballistic missiles from North Korea. The United States looks forward to continuing to work with its friends and allies to defend against the threat posed by the proliferation of ballistic missiles.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.